Okay, let's start. Good afternoon. End of another long week. One more week to go. Okay. One more week to go. I'm still debating whether I should bring some cookies next time. I'm not sure how many are going to be here. I'm kind of expecting sort of between 20 and 50, but we'll see. we'll see. Okay. Quite a few people have already submitted the assignment. Here, you can do this after the lecture as well if you want. Remember, the deadline is next Tuesday at 11 a.m. rather than p.m. Okay. So if you haven't finished yet, please make sure that you hand it in time. Still lots of people joining, okay. Yes, there was a typo. I don't know how many people saw it. I got one or two concerned emails about the fact that I mistyped or misspelled analysis. If you faithfully entered analysis, you didn't get any hits. I'm not quite sure whether I should reward you for that because I don't know. But anyway, obviously I meant discourse analysis. Okay, so that was purely a typo. Also, for those of you who haven't handed it in yet, I just wanted to remind you that when I mean use the Oxford English Dictionary online, I mean use the Oxford English Dictionary online. I just remembered from last year that quite a few people seem to have different sources for answering those questions. The idea is that you get familiarized, or that you familiarize yourself with the Oxford English Dictionary online interface, which is available at www.oed.com, and that you make use of that. Those were the announcements. Unless there are any other things to ask or say, I'd like to continue with the fourth lecture on syntax. Is that bright enough? Can you see it, or do you want me to put you into sleep mode and make it darker? Make it darker? Okay, don't fall asleep. The problem is I can now probably just click once more and it'll go completely dark. Let's see. No, okay. Fine? Better? Okay. Good, let's start. What I've done in the past three lectures, meaning three lectures on syntax or on grammar, although, of course, grammar is both morphology and syntax together, but let's say the last few lectures, I've looked at some of the basic features that we need. We looked at word classes, we looked at phrases, we looked at clauses, and we looked at some trees, and my main point was that I wanted you to see how the hierarchical relationships are in such sentences. Okay. So we have phrases within phrases, clauses within phrases, etc., etc. Okay. And I also introduced you to some concepts. Some of them are more difficult than others, namely features of the verb phrase, tense, aspect, mood, voice, etc. Okay. What are we going to do today? Today I'd like to look at variation with you. And in fact, variation is going to be important for much of the second semester as well. You're going to look at variation, regional variation, other types of variation, also historical variation. But I'd like to mention a few points that are important for syntax and variation already today, and you may return to one or two of those next semester. So we'll have a look at different text types or different registers. In fact, we're also looking at different modes, spoken versus written. I also, yeah, spoken versus written is actually here on the third point, the third point on the list. I'd also mention a few non-standard features of syntax.
Okay.
Or features of non-standard dialects or varieties of English. I'll almost finish. Don't make me throw someone out again today, please. Okay. I felt rather silly last time. Yeah. This is university, not school. Good. I'll finish with a few points on word order and some final fun. Okay. What do I mean? I'd like to show you just one or two things which I find interesting, which aren't really part of what you need to know, just to give you an idea of what else is out there. Okay. No, you do not need to know this for the exam, and it's only going to be 3 or 4 slides. So, yeah. Okay, I'd like to return to the discussion of tense, and in fact I'd like to for a moment look at the present tense. I mean, we all know what the present tense is, like he goes to London. In fact, this is what we would call the simple present. It's the base form of the verb, usually with the exception of the third person, which we've got here, where we've got the third person singular s, the inflectional morpheme indicating third person singular present. Okay. I'd like to look at some different meanings of the present tense now with you, and I would like to look at how they are used in different contexts for different purposes and in different text types. In fact, what you probably learned at school, I don't know, is that there are 2 major meanings and 1 minor. So let's just repeat those. One of the major meanings is something referring to a current state. So the bus has 4 wheels. Okay. So it must be a small bus, I guess. Okay. The other one is habitual action, something that you do on a regular basis, or some kind of general truth. I give lectures on Friday afternoon. I take the bus to work, etc. Okay. Those are the 2, I guess, major meanings. There's also sort of a minor one which refers to current action. Here comes the bus. Okay. And in fact, in most contexts, we would probably use a progressive in this situation. Okay. Why am I telling you all of this? Well, because this is sort of the standard textbook picture, I guess. But it's quite interesting to see how the tenses are actually used in different text types. Okay. Now, one question we could ask is whether there are text types which particularly favor certain tenses, or where we are most likely to find the use of certain tenses. Okay. And if you think about it, conversation, spontaneous conversation, is something that we do in the here and now, so we very often use present tense. Of course, when we narrate something about the past, we might switch back to the past tense, or we might switch to the past tense, but in general, it's something that we might use more often than in other text types in conversation, and in fact, also in academic prose. Also, in text types like this, and a forehand reply of the first point of the tie break, and here comes Henman with a forehand, and Gustafsson, I guess, goes cross-court, and Henman is in behind his forehand, etc., etc. Okay, I'm not a sports reporter, as you can tell. I couldn't read this very well. This is sports commentary. Lots of present tense, and it makes sense, because you're basically describing what's going on right now. Okay, those were the basics, and I now would like to build up from there. Does present tense mean present time? I think I've already mentioned that this is not necessarily the case. We can use present tense to refer to the future. And I made the point already that we don't have a future tense in English, that this is really only something, I mean, tense is only something that is marked morphologically on the verb. So, if we have, it's open day on Wednesday, okay, what's an open day? An open day at university in Britain is where people who might go and study at this university can find out more about the university. Okay. So it's open day on Wednesday. That's not now. That's in the future. Okay. But it's in the present tense. Of course, what we have here to support this is the time adverbial on Wednesday. So I'm not saying that the present tense on its own means the future, but it can mean the future, or it can refer to the future. Okay. And usually we need some additional elements to support this. Can we refer to the past time? So yesterday afternoon, Pete comes home from fishing, and he's got this huge fish with him. Okay. He has got. He comes home from fishing, but yesterday. Okay. This is something that you might have encountered before. It's sometimes referred to as the conversational historic present. Okay, or the historical present tense. Now, this is something that we do quite a lot when we tell stories. And I'm going to come back to that when we are looking at the differences between spoken and written syntax in about half an hour or something like that. But the point I wanted to make at the moment is that tense and the time that it refers to isn't clear-cut. Okay. Present tense tends to refer to the present and now, but it doesn't have to. Now, something like prose fiction will show a strong preference for the past tense. Okay. Narrating facts about the past. Once upon a time, I mean, this is prose fiction of a specific type, it's maybe a fairy tale. Once upon a time, there lived a pretty little girl. When she was young, her mother sadly died. Her father remarried, but the girl's stepmother was a mean woman with two ugly daughters. Okay. I seem to be a better teller of fairy tales than of sports commentary. May have to do with the fact that I have children. But anyway, lots of past tense here. Okay. Lived, was, died, remarried, and was. Very typical. Okay. Just try it. Put it into the present tense. It doesn't feel like a present. No, it doesn't feel like a fairy tale anymore. Okay. And of course, you're aware of the fact that we need to report. Well, we need to backshift when we have indirect speech that, or thought that is reported. Okay. There is a meeting this week, and he said there was a meeting next week. So this is also used for the past tense. Now, as with the present tense, which can refer to the future or to the past, in fact, the past tense doesn't necessarily refer to the past. Only, did you want a cup of tea? Okay. That is, well, now, or in fact, future. Okay, but we're using a past tense form for this. This is, of course, fairly unusual. Okay, so that was the point that I wanted to make. We have different tenses. We have different text types that are more likely to have one tense than the other. And we have no one-to-one relationship between tense and the time that it refers to, although they are clear tendencies. That was something on tense. I'd like to move over to noun phrases now. You should now be able, quite easily, to find the noun phrases here. And maybe I should give you a minute to do this. There will be one or two such occasions this lecture. Can you see whether you find all the noun phrases in this short extract? And we will then look at different text types and see whether there is something different about the noun phrases. Okay. I'll just color it for you. These are the noun phrases. Here we've got a comma between noun phrases. Now what you might have, I mean some of you might have been tempted to have those two as one noun phrase. I can see why, but they are really two different ones. This is something that we haven't discussed. It's something like, the technical term for this is apposition, but yes? Have I managed to? Just a sec. Yeah, I see what you mean. Yes, good point. But is it the floor that's referring to? That's actually modified. Sorry?
Is it the newly installed laser light show?
Yes, exactly. Laser light show, or the light show, or in fact show, is the head. And you're absolutely right in pointing that out. Thank you very much. I probably have just made exactly the kind of mistake that I told you not to make before, but you're absolutely right. Showing the newly installed laser light show, which was pumping out some very pacey techno, is one noun phrase. Yes, okay. 10 points for you. Well done. Okay. Yes. Okay, good. I could have claimed, yeah, put this in so that you find it, but that's wrong. I simply overlooked that. The main point, it's partly because I want to make a different point with this, but you're absolutely right. Okay. I'm also coloring the head nouns here. Okay. Because that allows us to see what type of noun phrases we have here. It's always, well, it's either just a head noun and nothing else, as we've seen before, but we have a lot of noun phrases where there is something preceding, some modification, or obviously we've got the determiners, like the, etc. Yeah. But with the exception of the relative clause, which has been spotted now, notice that we have a lot of pre-modifying elements. Okay? Now, compare this to this text. Yes?
The head noun can just be one word, right?
Yes, exactly. The head noun can be just one word. Because it's the most important word. It's the head, and I mean, you can think about the fact you can't live without your head, in that sense. Yeah, if it's not there, then, okay, there are a few other things that you can't live without. It's not the best comparison, but it's like, it's the most important element. Okay. Let's look at this one then. Do you find any noun phrases here? Again, color it for you, and in fact, I'm going to add a few more colors in a minute. Okay. Now, these are the noun phrases at the top level, and I hope I'm right this time. A student, an academic offense, under section A11, the invigilator, etc., etc. Now, why do I say that I'm going to add new colors or additional colors? Because just as we saw before in the other text, we have some additional noun phrases that are lower down in the hierarchy. So, for example, the director of student services is a noun phrase, but student services is a noun phrase within a preposition phrase within the noun phrase. Okay? And full details of the circumstances of the alleged offense is a noun phrase, which contains the circumstances of the alleged offense as a noun phrase, which, in fact, contains the alleged offense inside it. Okay. So we have a preposition phrase within a preposition phrase within a preposition phrase, etc. So it's a stacked set of phrases there. Okay. And within each preposition phrase, we have a noun phrase. Okay. So, if you... Yes? And in closing, a written. I guess, gosh. Let's see. Providing with a written report, giving full details of the circumstances of the. And which is. This is actually an interesting sentence. Because, think about it. Wait a minute. And immediately after the examination, provide him with a written report. What's the subject of this? The report is giving, but enclosing, is the report enclosing? I'm not sure whether it's really the report that's enclosing. What is it?
Is a report of the details that I enclosed.
A written report giving full details of the circumstances. Yeah. And the report. Gosh, you got me. Yes? No, it's not an object. That clearly not.
Report is not the object to enclosing, so I think it's quite that it's not.
Yeah, but I mean, if we say with a written report, which is giving,
yeah.
And which is enclosing?
No,
right? Sorry.
It's which encloses.
Yeah, but we have enclosing. Yeah, but I still wonder what the subject is. What I suggest, since I need to finish before you want to go, everyone, I'll think about this. This is actually a more interesting sentence than I thought it would be. Okay, and yes, I admit I haven't thought about this enough. I need to redo that for next. No, I'm not giving it next year anyway. But anyway, I will post this online, and I'll come up with a good explanation of what's going on here and. Where the subjects are. But I have to say, good, you're spotting all of that, okay? It's not really what I wanted in the sense of that's not what I'm after, but I think you're right. There are things to be said here, okay? Good, okay. I never said it was easy. Good, okay. Right. But I think you will probably agree with me anyway. That there is a difference between the two texts. Okay. The second text, which I've just shown you, contains noun phrases with post-modifying elements. Yeah. We have relative clauses. Okay, we had a relative clause in the other one too, but we have a lot of preposition phrases that modify. Okay. The noun phrases of the first text are simpler, because they only, with the exception of one relative clause, contain pre-modifying elements, if any. Okay. Now, it might be, and I think it is, if you look at lots of data, then you see this repeated. This might be because there is a difference between journalistic prose and legal language. Legal language tends to contain more post-modifications of a more hierarchical, more stacked type. Okay? There is another text type which it's related to the first one, hard news. Okay? Newspaper reports, but not of the sort about music, etc., but about real news or business news as well. Have a look at this. The collapsed London Docklands developer Kentish Property Group. Okay. Or Los Angeles radio talk show host. Or Light Rapid Transit Project Team member Mark Haslam. Okay. IRA assassination target Sir Peter Terry. Okay. What is this? These are sequences of six nouns. Yeah. Okay, some of them are sequences of six nouns because it's a name like Sir Peter Terry. Okay. But even so, it's clearly something which is a very dense way of packaging information. This is something that you see a lot in newspaper language. Okay. Why? Because it saves space. Okay. If you have to say the same, you can say the same thing with a post modification with an off preposition phrase. But if you can just basically stack it up as pre modifications, you save space. The fact that this is actually very text type specific can be seen here. I looked at sequences of six nouns in a row in the British National Corpus, and I looked at how frequently that happens in newspapers, academic prose, fiction, and the spoken context governed part, which is basically lectures, radio, phone, and spoken data, but not spontaneous conversation. And you can see a very, very clear difference between newspapers and the other text types. So it seems to be something that's really related to newspaper discourse. Okay? So we can use the terminology that I introduced, or the knowledge about syntactic features of language in general, to compare different text types and to describe their properties. Okay, their syntactic properties, but we can link this up to other elements or to other important facts, like, for example, the need to be precise but within a short, not span of time, but within very little space. Okay, I wanted to show you a few things about spoken versus written language now. And for this, I reused a few slides from a lecture that I did in a different lecture, but I left the old layout there. So sorry for the layout change, but I'm sure you can handle it. Okay. A bit of this nice violet or whatever it is doesn't hurt, right? What's that, written or spoken? I think the answer is very clear, very easy to say. And then in the blowing clouds, she saw a band of feigned iridescence, colouring in faint colours a portion of the hill. I think few people would speak like that. Okay. They might, if they've learned it by heart. How do you know? Well, for various reasons. Number one, perhaps vocabulary. But as I'll show you, it's also got to do with syntax or with grammatical elements. Okay. This is, in fact, from D.H. Lawrence, The Rainbow, and it talks about the rainbow. Let's have a look at another description of the rainbow. Normally, after very heavy rain or something like that, you're driving along the road and far away you see, a series of stripes formed like a bow, an arch, very, very far away. Seven colours, but I guess you hardly ever see seven. It's just a series of colours which they seem to be separate, but if you try to look for the separate colours, they always seem very hard to separate, if you see what I mean. Okay. Now, this may have sounded slightly artificial, and you think, no one's speaking like that. But yes, of course, we all speak like that all the time. Maybe as a little piece of homework, you can just listen to, if someone tells you something, how well-formed their sentences really are, how often they break off, how often they perform false starts, how often they actually produce ungrammatical sentences, but you have absolutely no problems with that. Okay. We will be talking about analyzing spoken language later on in the course when we talk about discourse analysis, and then we'll return to one or two features that I mentioned today. For example, features like this, or something like that. Why not just after very heavy rain? Why does the speaker need to say, or something like that? Okay. Well, or some kind of filled pause. I guess. Okay. It's not literal guessing. It's a marker of not being entirely sure about what to say. What's odd here? Which they seem to be. If you remember, we looked at relative clauses. Okay, the colors, which, and what is the subject in the relative clauses? The colors which seem to be far away, or which seem to be separate, sorry, which. But we have a repetition of a subject, which they seem to be far away. That's a straightforward error. Okay? It's ungrammatical. Happens all the time in spoken language. And then in the end, if you see what I mean. Okay? So, clearly spoken and written language is very different. It's different on a structural level as well. Here is a description of Old MacArthur. Old man MacArthur, he was a wee chap, small chap, oh, very small, and a beard. And he was pretty stooped. Okay? That's how we would explain or how we would describe someone in spoken language. I guess this is how we might want to do a similar thing. I mean, it's not the description of the same person, but it's a description of a man. A man who turned into a human torch 10 days ago after snoozing in his locked car while smoking his pipe has died in hospital. Okay? What do we have here? One large noun phrase. Yeah? With a relative clause and various other levels down in the hierarchy. Okay? So, in the spoken text, we basically have sort of single chunks. Yeah? He's small, he has a beard, and he walks a bit like that. Okay. But in the written text, we can condense information within the noun phrase.
But in literature, the first sentence could be also kind of introduction, so it could also be a written language.
Yes, okay, everything that I'm saying now here, in this context, is not this is 100% written, this is 100% spoken. Okay, and I'll make this point in a few minutes on a separate slide. I'm talking about tendencies. Okay, there are some things like the description of the rainbow, you would hardly see this in writing unless someone uses it in a novel to pretend it's spoken. Yeah, of course. But there are tendencies. I mean, you can actually, of course, find sentences that are similar in spoken data, but you're much less likely to do this. So, spoken language varies on several levels. Lexis, okay, different words are used. The density, how compact the information is, how it is packaged, and also on the level of syntax. Which structures are more likely to be used, etc. Now, why is this so? This is something that has to do partly with the fact that we're producing language, and I like to call this online. When you write, you sit down, you have time to think about what you want to write, you have time to correct yourself, you can formulate the individual chunks that might be in your head in such a way that they become rather condensed. But if you do this online, in the sense of if you just basically speak, And you constantly need to adapt to the new situation. Like your conversational partner says something and you want to react to that. Then you need to react quickly. And this requires, well, your brain power. And your brain power is limited. Okay. You can't talk in convoluted hierarchical speech at high speed for 1 minute in a row. Okay. Unless you've learned it by heart. Okay. So that explains some of the differences clearly. But it's not only that. In fact, some people have postulated that spoken and written language have a different grammar. Okay. Jeffrey Leach, a former colleague of mine in Lancaster, he's written about this, and he says there are basically three options that one can look at. First of all, some people seem to think that spoken English has no grammar at all. Right? It's chaos. I can already tell you that's wrong. You know that. But anyway, this is one way of looking at it, and I'll give you an example in a minute. Or we could say spoken English does not have a special grammar. It's the same as the grammar of written language. And then an alternative sort of middle way would be to say that there are some differences. It does have a special grammar. It's got its own principles, rules, and categories, which are different from those of written language, at least in some aspects. Okay. Now let's have a look at this one. Is this chaos? This is actually a real transcription of something that someone said. Now, do you know where the where the fire station is? Not the one that white. Okay. To be honest, I have no idea in what context this was produced, and I probably haven't produced it in any way that's similar to what the person said. And I'm also quite sure that it probably made sense to whoever he spoke to. But if you try to analyze this syntactically, it's nonsense. Okay. And this kind of thing suggests to some people that spoken language doesn't really have grammar. Okay. But then again, we, of course, also have things like this. The trouble is, if you're the only one in the house, he follows you and you're looking for him, and every time you're moving around, he's moving around behind you, so you can't find him. I thought, I wonder where the hell he's gone. I mean, he was immediately behind me. This is about a man who's looking for his dog. Okay. This is perfectly acceptable grammar. It's fairly simple sentences, and it's coordinated with ands and things like that. But there is nothing that suggests that spoken language or spoken English has no grammar. So you can forget that. Okay. But there is some disagreement as to whether spoken language truly has a completely different grammar or whether it's really absolutely the same. And I'd like to look at some of the differences in a little bit more detail, and then you can make up your mind as well, or yourself. Now, this is actually the slide that I was referring to before. The differences that I'm going to say are not categorical, but it's got to do with what is more likely. Which of the two sentences or utterances is more likely to be spoken? I think you can agree with me that it's A. But both are possible. One is much more likely than the other. Okay? So we look at different probabilities of occurrence of a certain structure in different registers or in different modes, like spoken versus written. And if we have large text collections of spoken data, spoken corpora, I'll come back to corpus linguistics in weeks 15, then that can help. Okay. Now, for the next few minutes, I'd like to show you some of the special features of spoken language that may not be immediately obvious to you, and that, to some extent, contradict what you've learned about the grammar of English, but that are nevertheless absolutely okay. Can you notice anything odd here? This is someone calling up a travel agent. Oh, hello. My husband and I are wanting to go to Hoek of Holland next weekend. Is there anything which strikes you as slightly odd? Yeah? My husband and me. Okay. All right. You're referring to something else. Okay. My husband and I versus my husband and me. Who finds my husband and me acceptable? Okay. Who thinks it's wrong? Okay. Yes. This is actually a different issue that I wasn't going to talk about today. if you think about it, then me is used in context where we would use in German a different case from what's normally the case in the subject. Yeah? Nominative versus dative, etc. Give me, wem, dative. Okay. Now what do we have here? Do we have I in subject position? Or do we have I in a complement position, an object position? Well, my husband and I is subject. So this is the correct form if you look at it from a point of view of a prescriptive linguist. But a lot of people would actually say, my husband and me are wanting to go to Hoek van Holland. People would then, some people would actually consider this wrong, but it happens all the time. And that, in fact, would have also been a feature of spoken language, which is, strictly speaking, not right, but which everyone does anyway. Okay. So that's not the point that I was referring to. But there's another one. Yes?
I'd say I want
to. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. What is this? This is... What is it? What kind of form? Yeah? It's a progressive, exactly. Present progressive, yes. Why a present progressive with a verb that is not to be used, or that is not supposed to be used in the progressive? It's, well, want is not something that usually is in the progressive, yes.
Since you're replacing by are willing to go?
Are willing to go? But that would be rather odd. That's like someone is forcing you to go, and okay, we're willing to go, and the others can stay. Yes, there's someone up there. On the, yes?
It's a regular verb.
Yes. Now, there is something expressed on top of what we would expect with this. This is subtle. This is very subtle. Okay? Yeah?
So, by using the progressive, you're saying that you are doing something actually.
Yeah.
They are going there and buying the tickets.
No, you're just calling up, no? Yeah, I think you were first. And yeah?
Maybe it's just that you're a little girl, like you're not quite sure, so you're asking.
Yeah? What was it?
I guess it's just a polite way of asking.
A polite way of asking, yeah? Replace it with the non-progressive form. My husband and I want to go to Hoek van Holland. Hoek of Holland. Okay, all right. I've put in a different intonation now, slightly. But I want to do this is much less, a much more sort of more direct, much more assertive than if you say I'm wanting to do this. Yeah? Now this is subtle, but it's making use of a form that is part of the verbal structures of English, in a context where we wouldn't really expect it, and the reason is to make it less direct, more non-assertive, more polite. Okay? And it makes sense within this conversational situation, but not sense within the rule of standard grammar, of standard written grammar. Yes, a question. Of course you could do this. Of course you could say, would like to go to, and that would also be polite. Okay? Very often in language you have different options. Okay? But the point that I wanted to make, that this option that is chosen is actually one which is slightly odd from a syntactic point of view, but which can be explained by additional elements that are sort of superimposed on the structure in spoken language. And if that happens again and again and again, then maybe you have to say, this is not wrong, this is the grammar of spoken language. Yeah? I'll give you another one here. So all of that. You see, when you devolve power as they did with the divisional structures, just all went off and did their own thing. And unfortunately, we're having to sort of come back from that and say, well, is that the most cost-effective because we've got to cut our costs? It's in a way the same thing again. We're having to sort of come back. Just imagine the speaker saying, and we have to come back. It's much more assertive. We also have the sort of here, which is odd, which is also spoken, because why? It's not a sort of thing, it's not a kind of thing, but it's something that I will be calling a hedge later on. We're hedging our bets a little bit here. So it's indirect, and it's expressing a non-assertive stance of the speaker. Okay, that was just another example of the same thing. Okay, we can also look at grammatical features and look at where they occur in larger stretches of text. What we've done largely so far is to look at just sentences. But let's look at a slightly longer text. Do you notice anything here? This is telling a story about how difficult it was to buy his favorite ice cream, a Magnum, in a small provincial English town. Okay. So we're looking in there and we can't find any Magnums. So we turn around and he actually interrupts his phone call to say, you know, what are you looking for? And we said, have you got any Magnums? Says speaker two. And he sort of shook his head in a way as to say, no, you know, we don't get such things. It was a complete rejection. And we sort of took a step back from the thing, and there it was, labeled Magnum. Bit of an odd story, but that's not the point. Is there anything odd here with respect to... Yep.
The third line is written what you would be beforehand. So in written language, you would write down where you are.
What are you looking for? Okay, so we've got an omission of the element that's carrying tense. Yes, what you're looking for. Maybe the transcriber didn't hear it, or what you're looking for is sort of very... connected speech. Remember that we looked at what happens in connected speech, but that's not the point. Yes?
Sorry?
Magnum has two different meanings. That's also not the point. Yes? Look at tense. Yeah? This is a case of the historic present. And it's got to do with the fact that the speaker wants to transmit or wants to communicate sort of some kind of background or something that's happening. And then when the important bit of information comes, they switch tense. This is quite odd. And strictly speaking, both occur in the same temporal situation. Yeah? So it seems to be a narrative strategy. I'll give you another example. So we were in this car, it was just in this lot, and all of a sudden the buzzer sounds. Okay? We have a setting, and then we have something happening. And in this case, we have past tense first, and then the historic present for the thing that suddenly happens. So, we could also have done this very differently. We were sitting in the car when the buzzer sounded. Okay. But, in spoken language, this seems to be possible in different ways. Or, when I went to see it, the guy says to me. Okay. So, it's a rhetorical device. It's something that we use to foreground or to indicate this is something that's important or that's the action that I would like to focus on. Okay? But strictly speaking, it's wrong in a sense, you know, because we're switching tense for no reason, even though we're referring to something that is in the past. Okay? Now, I'm not saying that everything that you learned so far needs to be scratched and you can forget about tenses and things like that. That's not what I'm saying. I'm trying to look at how spoken language seems to allow certain things that are not covered by standard grammar. The people who've looked at this, or some of the people who've looked at this in detail, are McCarthy and Ron Carter. There is a paper written by them in 2001. Such variation, they say, is by no means random or unmotivated. You know, it's not a mistake. It's not something that happens because the speaker isn't thinking right. You know? But it coincides with important segments of the narrative where listeners are, as it were, taken in and out of the story world in real time, as though they are participating in the drama themselves. Okay? And I'll go on with another quote from them. The point to be made here about spoken grammar is that a wide section of strategies is available to speakers to create and reinforce relationships, to involve or detach their listeners, and that the verb phrase morphology plays a key role in signaling these functions. It's as if there was sort of an additional layer on top of things. And I think that's quite interesting. I don't know whether you share that view, but it's something that you may not have considered before. In fact, you can also see this in positions of elements that we looked at when we looked at clauses. This may strike you as slightly odd. Spanish is more widely used, isn't it, outside of Europe? Or, I was worried I was going to lose it, and I did, almost. You know which one I mean, probably. It's a bit panicky, but I've not got any deadlines like you have, though. Okay. Now, all of these sentences or utterances or whatever we should call them they contain elements which are somewhere different in the clause structure from where we would usually expect them to be. And this perhaps has to do with what I've said before, that we've got these real-time constraints. Okay. But it may also have to do with the way we, this is a difficult word, topicalize things, the way we put emphasis on what's important and things that are really sort of some kind of afterthought. Okay. Have a look at those ones here. Need to speed up a little bit, so I'll do this more quickly. Actually, no, I don't think I need to speed up that much. I haven't got that much left. What's special here? Paul, in this job that he's got now, when he goes into the office, he's never quite sure. We introduce Paul first. It would have been fully grammatical to say, in this job that he's got now, Paul goes into the office, etc. So we seem to sort of almost repeat the subject too often. Remember the relative clause of the rainbow where we had a repetition of the subject. Or a friend of mine, his uncle had the taxi firm when we had the wedding. This is, strictly speaking, wrong. But it has to do with the fact that you first want to highlight the relationship with that person, a friend of mine, and then go on saying what's important. Okay. Anyway, there's no time to look at this in any greater detail. I'd like to show you one or two more things, and then I stop with spoken versus written language and come back to, or go back, or go to non-standard aspects. The second one is perhaps something that we should quickly look at. The first one too, very quickly. And he's quite a comic, the fellow, you know. This is odd. Why is it odd? Because what do we usually do? We usually introduce a new referent, and we do this with a noun phrase. And then once that referent was introduced, or has been introduced, we refer back to it with a pronoun. Here, we've got the opposite. And he is quite a comic, the fellow. rather odd. Or, it can leave you feeling very weak. It can, though, apparently, shingles. Can it? Okay, shingles is an illness. Okay. So, the noun phrase content is left until the end. Why is that? Well, MacArthur and Carter say such right dislocated, that's a special term that you don't need to worry about, elements tend to have a strong evaluative function and usually occur in contexts where speakers are expressing judgments, opinion, stance. Okay. Think back, look at this. He's quite a comic, the fellow. That expresses a meaning or an attitude of the speaker. And it seems to be related to this structure. Okay, that was enough linguistics for today, I guess. Right, I made the point that these are errors in some way, but in fact they're not, because they make sense within spoken language. Of course, we also have things that really, truly, in a way, are errors. But even there, I would like to claim that these are actually not production errors, but maybe regularities in spoken language. Here we've got another one of those where the subject is repeated. Okay, which, that was just one of those things. Like in the rainbow example. Or look at this. It should fit there, because it's not that big, I don't think. This is, again, quite odd, because it's some sort of double negative meaning. It's not a traditional double negation, but we don't really need the I don't think. We would need I think. Okay. So, what do we do with those? Okay, here is a long quote, but it's virtually the last thing I'm going to say about spoken language. The important criterion here for a spoken grammar is that irregularities, wrong things, errors, and anomalies that may go against the grammarian's instincts concerning correctness or acceptability should first be checked as to their distribution across speakers and context. And where a sufficient number of examples from different speakers in different contexts suggest that a feature is normal and widespread, then it should be entered into grammar, even though it may still be deemed unacceptable in more formal contexts or in writing. Okay. So, we're looking at language use, we're looking at how it is actually used by a lot of native speakers, and even though it doesn't conform to the rules of grammar, we will be happy, or perhaps we need to, amend our grammar of spoken language. So to summarize what I've said about spoken versus written language, we've seen that they clearly differ in some ways. Okay. I mentioned the concept of a spoken grammar, but people disagree about this. It's the probabilistic nature that I mentioned before that is important to remember. Okay, probabilistic nature. If we say that we want to introduce a spoken grammar, then it requires some rethinking about some of the basic units of language. Okay. Even the sentence as such is perhaps no longer a fixed unit. And they have to do with the reasons with reasons of the situation of speaking. I just was looking for the right words. With reasons of, etc. Yeah. So you realize that I didn't quite know what to say, and how do I phrase it in such a way that you can make sense of it? I didn't do this on purpose. Yeah, I only, and then I realize, no, wait a minute, I want to do this differently. Okay. If I do this in very distinct ways that are repeated again and again by lots of speakers, maybe it's part of the spoken grammar. And you can decide by looking at large corpora and look at something that's happening very frequently rather than just the odd performance error. Okay, back to the old layout. And a few more minutes left, a few more slides. So far we've really looked at the standard English picture. But you probably are aware of the fact that dialects, just as German dialects, can have rather different features, can also vary with respect to different English dialects in Britain or in the States. Father were very tired when he got home. It's not was, it's were, and that's a feature that is very common in many British dialects. Or, this is a standard sentence. I was sitting outside the building when he arrived. I could now ask, what is it, what kind of form? And you would probably answer correctly, past progressive, and this is an aspect. It's a past tense form of the of be and the present participle ing. Now, where I used to work, all over the place actually in Britain, but particularly I noticed it where I worked in the north of England, northwest of England, I heard this form very, very often. I was sat outside the window, outside the building when he arrived. Okay. You can sit outside the window. What's wrong with that? Okay. So what do we have? Past tense form of be plus past participle. So we use a past participle for the perfective aspect in standard English. So this is not what we would expect. But it's a feature which is very common in non-standard varieties of English. You also find non-standard relative clauses. Remember, relative clause, the man who is sitting on the chair is my father. Remember also the relative clause post modifies the noun phrase. Not the noun phrase, the noun, the hidden noun in the noun phrase. As we saw today, we've got a restrictive relative clause here. Now, where exactly is the relative clause here? This is the man I love. This is the man who that I love. Okay, so we seem to be able to leave out the relative pronoun. Okay, so far, there's nothing odd about this. Yeah. In fact, this is very, very frequent in spoken language. Okay. But I would like to say something in this connection. We've got, this is the man I love, this is the first one. So it's only your grandfather lives there. This is a sentence, an utterance that was said to me while sitting in a car in Australia, and it was spoken by an Australian who was a native speaker of Australian English, who was asking about my grandfather. So it's only your grandfather lives there. Is that correct? Is that acceptable? And if not, what's wrong? You wanted to say that, yeah? It's absolutely okay if I say, so it's only your grandfather who lives there. And in fact, most prescriptive grammarians or most teachers, etc., would say, you can't say, so it's only your grandfather lives there. But why is it possible with the first one, it's the man I love? Why shouldn't it be possible in the second sentence? If you can answer this, you've already understood quite a lot of things about grammar and syntax, and you've listened for the past 3 lectures and have learned something. Why is this not possible? Well, let's first look at the first one. This is the man I love. What kind of verb is love? It's a transitive verb. Okay? You love somebody. So you need a subject, I, and you need an object, the person who is loved. What's the object? This is the man I love. Who is the subject or what is the subject? Yes?
The man.
The man. Yes. The man. So it's really, this is the man who I love, the man, in a way. I mean, this is not obviously not there, but somewhere. Yeah? Okay. And the man has what function? Object. Okay? Let's have a look at this one. So it's only your grandfather lives there. What's the subject of live? Your grandfather. Yeah? So, unlike the first case, the relative pronoun doesn't replace the object. But the relative pronoun replaces the subject of the relative clause. And this is not possible, according to prescriptive rules, in subject-relative clauses. Okay? It is possible in spoken language. If you look in spoken corpora, you find this quite often. And I didn't interrupt my Australian friend and said, ha, you said something wrong there. In fact, I did say, thank you very much, that was a nice zero subject relative clause, I need to write it down, and he felt a little bit annoyed, but that's because it happens to linguists. So, I also like one of our lecturers, Carol Ebert. She's producing one feature that I'm currently interested in quite often, and every time she says it, I need to go and write it down. But I think she gets it right. I'm not correcting her, I'm just noting down peculiarities of spoken language. The thing that she's doing quite often is, the thing is that. Okay, so she repeats is. Okay. She does that because the thing is a unit that we retrieve from memory as a whole. And it's as if she hasn't realized that she's already said is. Okay. Of course she knows, but in spoken language, that happens. And it's a nice example of the fact that we seem to store things as whole units in the mind. Okay. Right, that was something, a bit of a digression on relative clauses. But there are more things we can say about relative clauses in connection with standard versus non-standard use. This is the woman who taught us. Fine. Okay? This is the woman which taught us. This is not supposed to be done in standard British English. There are dialects where this happens, and in fact, historically, this was possible too. This is the woman as taught us. Okay? It's a non-standard variety. Or this is the woman at taught us. Okay? You could probably think that it's related to that, okay? But it's a particular variety or particular dialect version. In fact, you even find this is the woman what taught us. Okay, which is, I think, one of your favorite mistakes. Yeah? I'm sure people like Carol Ebert and Michael Banks and Bill Argent keep telling you or have told you or will soon that what is not a relative pronoun. Okay. Well, it is in some dialects, but we're teaching standard English here, so you're still not allowed to use it. Okay. So, it's different in different dialects. Of course, there's also variation between British and American English, standard British and standard American English, in various areas. For example, in articles. An American English person is very, very likely to say, Fred is in the hospital, while the British English counterpart is likely to say, Fred is in hospital. Again, these distinctions are not 100% true because of contact between people, or contact between peoples, as we might even say, which is perfectly okay here. Another example. American English speakers are more likely to say Mexico wins against New Zealand, while the British English speaker might actually say Mexico win against New Zealand, and thereby stress the fact that Mexico is actually a team consisting of several people, and therefore is plural. Okay, while for the American English speaker this seems to be less important. You'll also get variation with respect to verb complementation, so what kind of forms verbs, phrases might have in the verb phrase. In American English, for example, people tend to say, do you want me to help set the table, or help me set the table? Okay. While a British English person is more likely to say, help me to set the table. Again, things are changing. One or two more there. This is real good. You might have encountered that. This is strictly speaking wrong because it should be really good, but American English speakers very often leave out the ly ending, the inflectional, the ly ending, the derivational morpheme, in adverbs. He sure wouldn't do that. Yeah, he surely wouldn't do that. You might even find different prepositions. I haven't seen him in years versus 4 years. Yeah. Or some more preposition. Students protest the war versus protest against the war, where we actually need a preposition in English, in British English, where the Americans are fine without. Okay. We could go on for a long time. Just the last one, under the circumstances versus in the circumstances. Okay, two more things to say. The first is about word order, and then two, three slides on what I call some additional syntactic fun. I don't know who it is, but there's someone called Sebastian who likes syntax trees. Okay? I gave her a book, and here's your favorite sentence again, the girl stumbled. And winter is a wonderful season. Now, we can look at the individual parts of the sentence and we can sort of abbreviate them. We could, for example, say that the first one has the structure SVO, subject, verb, object. The second one is different because it's a different type of verb. It's a ditransitive verb, so therefore we have a direct and an indirect object. So S-V-O-O, while the girl stumbled is only S-V. Remember, not everything that follows the verb must be an object. This is also the case here, where we don't really have a object. This is after the verb to be, a popular verb, which is called a subject complement. Okay. But we always have subject followed by verb. That's the important here. Yeah. So word order refers not really to the order of words, but to the order of constituents, the participants. And English is called an SVO language. Not necessarily every sentence has SVO. With the girl stumbled, there is no O. Does the subject always come first? Of course not. As soon as we make a question, then we require inversion of subject and verb. So this could be called VS, subject complement. Okay. We don't usually do this, but it's a different order. And in fact, with some types, or with many questions, we even need to add some kind of dummy element, as it's called. Does Sebastian like syntax trees? We can't say, likes Sebastian syntax trees? We could have done that 500 years ago. Yeah. But there are also other reasons for different word orders. I'd like to mention a few. We return to structures like this in a later lecture, but just quickly here. Potatoes I like, but chips I can't stand. What's this? We have the object pre-post before the subject. Why? Well, because we want to express a contrast. Then came the turning point of the lecture, or the match. Okay. What do we have here? We have inversion. Why? Because we have an adverb at the beginning. Okay. So there are good reasons why this can change. In the town where I was born lived a man who sailed to sea. Some people recognize that. Over the horizon lies a magical kingdom. So we seem to be it seems to be possible to invert word order after preposition, phrase, of location. Or, it's alive, exclaimed Andrew. We have inversion after quoted speech. Okay. So a lot of things of that, a lot of things that I said before sort of don't seem to apply as soon as we look at larger stretches of meaning. Yes. You couldn't use an exclamation mark like that.
Yes, it's not an order.
Sorry?
It's not an order. Maybe I'm remembering.
I have no problems with that exclamation mark. But then again, I'm not a teacher of English. So, I don't know. Who's not happy with the exclamation mark? Okay, one or two others. I don't know. I don't know. But I'm quite happy with this. Okay. The important bit is we have inversion. That's the thing here. Okay. Is it natural to say this, and I'm not talking about content, to draw a syntax tree in the middle of the night is fun? Is this the most natural way to say this? Can you make it more natural? What is to draw a syntax tree in the middle of the night, in terms of function? Subject. Yeah? But that doesn't sound right. Can you improve it? Yeah? Exactly. It's fun. Why is that more natural? Well, the subject is heavy. Yeah? It's somehow too long, okay? And the predicate comes much too late in the sentence. So we can use the it construction, the it extra position, to move the subject to the back. Yes? It sounds like what? What? Which one? The first one or the second one? The first one. Yeah, okay. Maybe you have that association, yeah. But, don't know. I don't know whether it's actually, it's got to do with being, I think it just sounds unnatural to have such a long, heavy subject, possibly. But you may be right. Okay. Let's have a quick comparison with other languages. And in fact, before I do this, I'd like to ask you to have a look at this extract for a sec. What is odd here? Is there anything wrong? Did our sister research center in Warrensville this morning? Did the same old talk about why we're here, etc.? Can you do this? Anything missing? Yep. What exactly do you mean?
Word to do is usually supporting another word.
You may mean the right thing, but yes. Whoever, I don't mind. Well, what? Our sister research center in Boron.
In the first sentence, did your sister do what?
Ah, okay. You're looking at this as if it was a question. No. Okay. What were you going to say? There was someone up there. Yeah.
One needs what is done actually.
Okay, so what's missing?
Missing.
And what function?
The subject,
yes. Okay. Okay, did in the sense of, this is a full verb do. I did this. Okay, so there's nothing meant, nothing left, nothing missing. I see what you mean as well. But the more important thing is that the subject is missing. Yeah. Can you usually do this in English? Not really. It's sort of possible in a formal email. This is a real email. Okay. You have to say, I speak English. You can't say, speak English. Well, then it's a command. Okay. Same in German. Ich spreche Deutsch. Je parle anglais. Well, Deutsch, English, anglais. Yes, okay. Yeah, that was French. Okay. Je parle anglais. Okay. Or parlo inglese. Ah, suddenly, wait a minute. There's no subject. Because the subject is included in the inflectional ending, so to speak. Yeah? Happens in Spanish as well. Gavariu paruski or pangliski. Okay? Same thing. There is no subject. Okay? These are pro-drop languages. Okay? Spanish, Italian, and Russian. They allow a null subject. Okay. So something isn't really possible in English that is possible in some other languages, but not in all. Okay. A bit more on German. Ich lebe in Trier. Okay. I live in Trier. Fine. Verb is where? In the second slot, because we have a subject, verb, object, order. Vor 3 Jahren lebte ich in Lancaster. 3 years ago, lived I in Lancaster. No, right? 3 years ago, I lived in Lancaster. Why is that the case? Because German is said to be a V2 language, where the verb is always in the second slot. So, different languages have different rules, and we have seen that these rules can be, to some extent, it's not really violated, but amended, because we're doing things in context, in larger stretches. Okay. And then there is also spoken language, which seems to have at least partly its own rules. Let's end with 2 slides, or 2 or 3 slides, of what I would like to call a final bit of syntactic fun. And you don't have to pack up now, because you'll get 2 cartoons in the end, so there is something to wait for. What's different between those 2 sentences, apart from the fact that it's a different verb? I asked him what to wear. I told him what to wear. Ask and tell are both verbs that require 2 elements. Tell somebody and tell somebody something. Yeah? What is what to wear? It's a subordinate clause. Yeah? What is the object in the subordinate clause? Well, the what, to wear what. And the what is sort of then pre-post. What's the subject? What's the subject of to wear? Yes?
I think in the first clause
it's I. Yes?
And in the second clause it is he.
Yes. Isn't that odd? Exactly the same structure, but different subjects that seem to depend on the verb. I don't know. Both are the same kinds of verbs, but it's really odd. Okay. That was the first bit of fun. I like syntax trees. I don't like syntax trees, some of you might say. And the not is used to negate the verb. Very easy, and it's contracted. Okay. It doesn't seem that we can get our money back. I don't imagine he'll come. I don't think this is fair. Can you rephrase this? What does it mean? Think about why I put this in red. It does not seem that we can get our money back. What is negated? Is it the seeming, or the imagining, or the thinking, or is it not rather that the element in the subclause, the verb in the subclause, is negated? This is as if the negation has moved up to the next level of hierarchy. This is called neg-raising, because you raise the negative element. Okay? And there are plenty of structures like that that are difficult to combine with what we've said so far. So, by way of conclusion, I introduced you to different words, phrases, clauses, and sentences. Well, not really to different, also to different sentences. Yeah. Complex, simple, and compound. I made a point about hierarchies. I tried to show you that trees are a good way to visualize them. Today we talked a little bit about variation. We finished on some aspects of word order and two, I thought, interesting additional points. So there's a lot more fun out there. Next time we're going to do semantics. Safari owl hacks his way through the jungle. Suddenly a giant gorilla rips through the foliage. Clean your room. What? You hurt me. It's a jungle in here. What's the meaning of jungle? A bushel is a unit of weight equal to 4 pecks. What's a peck? A quick smooch. You know, I don't understand math at all. If you don't understand that joke, you need to look up peck. Okay? And then you will have something that you need to know for the next lecture already. As of the next lecture, reading goes back to Finnegan, so please check online what the reading assignment is for next time. Next time, I'm sure we're going to have a big group here. See you next week.